Hey everyone, welcome to episode 46 of the Wake Up Podcast. On this one, I've got Sean Baker, a medical doctor. He's the founder of MeatRx, and he's one of my favorite carnivores. He's actually probably the person who coined the term, and I love his TikTok videos where he, you know, watches one of these vegan idiots on TikTok, you know, creating fake versions of meat like banana peel bacon and shit like that while he, you know, eats steak with a machete. It's hilarious. But look, Sean is a brilliant mind. He's a, you know, he's been a doctor for a long time. He understands the human body, understands diet, understands food better than just about anyone I think I've spoken to. And I've spoken to many people in this arena, and I've experienced a lot in this arena. So some of you would know that I was vegan for a couple of years. I was hell-bent on thinking that that was the right way to eat, until I realized the changes in my own body, the negative changes in my own body, and going back to eating meat and, you know, the boost in hormones that I got and the transformation that I made in my life almost 10 years ago now, you know, really paved the way for understanding food in a much more profound way, which other people also have, Sean being one of, I think, the people who gets it the most. So in this one, you know, we cover a whole broad range of things, like obviously the stupidity that's happening in the world, you know, the lockdowns, the you know, one of the examples was the Pinterest banning ads for like health and stuff like that, you know, because afraid of fat shaming people or whatever the case is. So we did that stuff. We also talked about, you know, keto versus carnivory, nutrient density. We spoke about fats and proteins. We spoke about other different foods, eating lifestyles, what actually matters with respect to protein and fat intake. So all sorts of things. It's a brilliant episode, and I plan to do much more of these kinds of episodes where we bring information in from the periphery that still is related to the idea of whether it's sound money, sound food, you know, sound energy, like what I did with Alex Epstein a couple episodes back. So hope you enjoy this. If you did, please share it around. And I hope anyone who's had questions for me about, you know, diet and the way of eating, etc., I hope you find loads of value in this. Thanks again, everyone, and I'll see you on the next episode. Welcome to episode 46 of the Wake Up Podcast. And today I've got Sean Baker, medical doctor, founder of MeatRx, and my favorite carnivore because he takes the piss out of vegans in the best way possible. Dude, thanks for coming on.
Hey man, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me. You know, it was cool running. You know, you'd have to tell them a story. We ran into each other randomly on the street in Laguna Beach, California. It was a kind of a bizarre encounter. I was walking down the street. Hey man, aren't you supposed to be on my podcast next week?
That was, yeah. And it was funny because I wasn't even supposed to be in Laguna that week. I was actually supposed to be in Miami, but there was a big clusterfuck with my flights, and then I ended up having to cross the Mexican border the way I did, and then I ended up, of all places, because I couldn't find where to stay. I was going to stay in Huntington Beach, and I found like a little spot in Laguna. So I'm like, fuck, I'll stay there for 2 days. And bumped into each other. That was like super, super, super strange. Like that kind of stuff happens to me all the time in California, actually. I bumped into Wim Hof as well in a similar sort of way. My flight in LA. I was there for an extra day, walking down the boardwalk and bump right. Wim Hof of all people. But look, since we're here, and you just mentioned you got banned off Twitter as well, and that was, you know, my crowning achievement of my life. What did you get banned for? Let's
see. It's interesting. So there was somebody that tweeted that I can't wait for them to get rid of people that don't preach the dietary dogma and get rid of misinformation, as they've been doing with some of the COVID stuff. And so I basically said this is a form of medical fascism, you know, nutrition fascism, and you know, these people decrying that stuff they don't agree with is considered censorable. And you know, I think mm-hmm. that I, you know, like I said, I don't care what what you said. I think you should have the right to say it. You should, you know, equally people should disagree with it and have their thoughts heard. And so, I mean, literally within 3 or 4 hours after that tweet went out, I got suspended. And I was like, what the hell did I say? Because I say, you know, I've said stuff like that similar before. And I've certainly, you know, I've certainly said things that piss people off, but I'm not inciting violence. I don't promote hate speech, any of that stuff. I do, you know, sometimes I call somebody an idiot, but I mean, they're being idiots. But so what they did is they said, well, they went back and they said, well, in 2019, you posted a video that had some music that was copyrightable. And so they basically banned me for that. And so, you know, again, I'm like, okay, that's fine. How do I resolve this? Well, you've got to talk to the person that complained about the copyright and get a retraction from them to have your account reinstated. So, you know, so I did that. But I mean, honestly, to me, it seems like it was selective enforcement of some, you know, crazy rule. You know, you have music playing in the background of one of your videos and they're going to like, that's copyrightable. You're banned from Twitter. And I mean, you know, obviously I think that, and I looked into this, I said, well, who gets banned for that? And they said, well, usually they give you 5 or 6 warnings. And that was like the first time I had seen anything like that. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me. So anyway, I'm currently banned. Will I get account back? I don't know. I had something like 80 some thousand followers. And so it's a little annoying, a little frustrating, but you know, and you know, like I said, it's not gonna stop me from continuing to talk like I do and be vocal and open about it. I think, you know, like I said, I think we have some problems with a lot of things, you know, and you talk about Bitcoin and how the typical monetary system is very problematic. I think the same thing we see in both healthcare and in nutrition and many other topics. And so hopefully
it really is.
This will be temporary. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, look, the thing is, I always find it ironic. You know, the books by Orwell and Huxley and all of those that were written as warnings, instead of being treated as warnings, they're almost being treated as guidebooks today by these idiots. You know, they're like, oh, you know, that's a good idea. Why don't we just like limit speech? You know, why don't we just, you know, like change the meaning or the definition of what words mean? Like, you know, if you're like, I saw a recent post, which is, it's apparently misogynistic. The reason we're killing the environment and we are increasing global warming is because masculine men refuse to stop eating meat. I was like, here we go. Like, you know, you and I are boiling the oceans, for eating meat.
Right. There's another article that said that men are worse for the environment than women due to the fact they like cars and eat more meat. And, you know, it's kind of like, so the answer is clearly ban men, you know, just ban men.
Yeah.
You
know? Let's just wipe them all out. It's, I think I actually saw this from you. I think another example of this madness, which is effectively what it's doing is it's narrowing the experience that is possible in life. So there was a good, I can't remember who said this, but basically the breadth of experience or the depth of experience you have in your life is correlated to the breadth of vocabulary. Like if you can't describe, or if you can't think, like you don't have the words to, you know, understand or appreciate the world you live in, like if you limit that and if you remove words from vocabulary, you actually narrow the breadth and scope of the individual's experience. And you know, I think Orwell articulated that extremely well in 1984, because you know, one of the primary means of control was they removed words from the fucking dictionary, and we're seeing that today. And I think it may have been you that posted this about Pinterest now like banning any health like ads or whatever it is, you know, fat phobia and whatever the fuck it is.
Yeah, you're not allowed to advertise diet or exercise or weight loss on Pinterest because it is, you know, I mean, obviously there's people that make money and scam people out of it. But I mean, at the same time, there's the aspect that if you show somebody that's healthy and encouraging people to lose weight, that is offensive to those people that choose not to do that. And I think it's just, you know, obviously I think it's absurd. And But you know, it's one of those things where you just kind of sit there, and I'm almost old enough where I'm just, you know, you want to check out and say, oh, screw it, it's the next generation's fault. But I can't quite do that. I'm not quite there yet. Yeah. Maybe we'll check back when I'm 80, when I'm finally said, F it. I'm just going to, you know, I still got a lot of fight left in me. So I think, you know, I've got kids that are, you know, I've got young kids that are, you know, between ages of 8 and 15, I got 4 of them. And so I want them to have a world that is not this Orwellian or dystopian craziness where, you know, like I said, you know, we're eating this synthetic slop and, you know, we're scared to, you know, to express ourselves. And I think that's something that is really being hampered right now, or at least potentially. I mean, we're seeing, you know, I just saw that, I mean, you know, we can get into this pandemic stuff, you know, in France, I think they've gotten a lot of backlash and they've retracted, but I mean, Macron basically said, you know, if you do not have a vaccine, and you enter a premises, we can throw you in jail for 6 months. And you know, I mean, can you imagine this conversation even 3 years ago? I mean, people would think you were just, you know, you would think it was a science fiction horror dystopian novel. I mean, this is a movie, and we're literally living that today, which is, you know, like I said, this is a blueprint. Is 84 and Animal Farm and all those things, are they blueprints for society? I it almost seems that way for sure.
It's extraordinarily sad. It's almost like I was on my old Twitter account. I was saying that it reminds me of the zombie apocalypse, you know, where everyone's walking around that's fucking mindless, right? And we're surrounded by these mindless idiots that are spreading more mindless. It's a pathetic version of the zombie apocalypse, because as opposed to, you know, guns and shooting zombies that are eating people's brains, we've got these zombies that are covering themselves in fucking face diapers, sitting at home, you know, ordering Uber Eats, watching Netflix, and trolling people on the internet, you know, being a fact checker. It's like, I didn't realize the apocalypse would be so pathetic. And we're kind of like, you know, in the midst of it. And the problem is I wrote an essay about this last year called Utopian Dystopias. And one of the things I discussed in there is, I said, when you optimize society for safety instead of freedom, what you get is the path of safety leads you to having your own prison. Effectively, the path of freedom leads you to growth. It's more dangerous along the way. You know, it's more difficult. It requires you to get out of your comfort zone, but it is the path of, you know, growth and freedom. Whereas the path of safety, like in some ways, you know, there was, one could argue that we needed to develop some level of safety because, you know, human beings, I'm out in Central America now. Like we grew up out of the fucking, the woods, the rock. Can you hear me again?
We're back. Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I've got you.
I wonder if,
what the fuck happened.
Maybe the Zoom sensors are watching and they don't want to have this dangerous conversation happen. Who knows? You know, it could be that.
Literally. They're like, quick, get him, take him down. So what I was gonna say was how sort of pathetic and afraid people have become. Like we grew up out of, we literally emerged from a hostile nature, and we, you know, we built these, you know, structures around us, you know, the homes and cities and, you know, machinery and all this sort of stuff to make life a little bit more comfortable and a little bit more efficient and functional, etc. But the pendulum swung so far that, you know, in Australia, that one of these politicians came out yesterday and saying, look, we know human beings are, you know, social creatures, but if you see your neighbor in the supermarket or outside, do not speak to them. Now is not the time to speak to people. I was like, what the fuck is wrong with you people? Like, that's how afraid society has become.
It's really horrifying to see that. I mean, you know, it's like, Australia's had, I think they said there's been a recent outbreak and they've had one death. Of an 80 something year old guy that, you know, I mean, how many 80 year olds die every day there? I mean, it's just like, are you going to shut down the country because somebody had a car accident? I mean, it's just, to me, that is just bizarre. I mean, it really is. And the fact that there aren't people that are just, you know, raising holy hell about that is beyond me. Maybe they are. And, you know, because we, you know, I mean, the one thing, and I've never been a big, like, Second Amendment, you know, you hoorah. I mean, I was a military guy, you know, I was issued weapons and I've been around, but I've never been one that really was somebody that was ranting about it. But at this point, it's kind of like, you know, you're seeing what these other companies are the countries are going through, and you're like, don't give up your guns. Don't give up your guns. You know, it's, you know, I think that's, I think, you know, and it might be that the United States is the last place in the world, the last free, truly potentially free place, you know, the way this stuff is going. So, I mean, it is a scary time. And the fact that people are willing to actually listen to a person saying that and actually think it's a good idea. I mean, it's so short-sighted. It is just, you know, like I said, I can't remember who said, you know, if you're willing to give up, freedom for safety, you get none.
Exactly. And that is that trade-off. And you know, when safety becomes the priority or the prerogative of a society, it slowly and incrementally leads to what we're seeing today, which is absolutely, absolutely pathetic. But anyway, I think we can go on that for ages. What I wanted to dig into a little bit of the carnival stuff, obviously. The reason I wanted to do this pod was I've tried everything. So I was a vegan for 2 years in my mid-20s, and my story was unique because I thought I found the fountain of youth. Like I started being vegan, you know, in the early period of being vegan, my skin cleared up, you know, I felt really energetic. I needed less sleep. I thought I figured this shit out. And I was in LA at the time. So what's this now? I was 24. So probably a good 9 years ago. And over time, so initially my strength increased, my energy increased, my stamina increased, all that sort of stuff. But then I started to plateau, and, you know, I tried to, like, you know, make changes and adjust the diet a little bit and say, you know, all right, I'll eat more hemp seeds and more avocado and all this shit. Right. And I wasn't one of these moron vegans who, like I've seen in your videos, where they literally fucking cook banana peels to try and make, you know, a replication of bacon. Like I was actually eating good food. And I plateaued, and then after a while I started getting weaker. And the two places where I saw it most was my sex drive went out the fucking window, and my strength, my testosterone levels just collapsed. And I went from, I remember I could probably bench press, and I'm thinking how to convert it into pounds. So like at the time I was 65 kilos. So like I would say I weighed about 140 pounds, 150 pounds. Yeah. Okay, yeah. So I could bench 200, no problem, 220, 230. Like I had a good strength to weight ratio, and it just got weaker and weaker and weaker till the point where I was only, you know, a 1-to-1. And I was like, something's wrong here. And I had this guy who was running a cafe, and he had been a vegan a decade prior. And he kept telling me, he's like, Alex, you're going to destroy your health. You're going to destroy your body. And I was like, fuck you, Pete. I know what I'm doing. You know, this is the way. Veganism is the way. And one day he slipped a bit of lamb into my food, and, you know, and he kind of knew that I was at the point where I was like, kind of had enough of this shit. And I ate it, and he's like, how did that taste? And I was like, man, that tasted really fucking good. Like, you know, it was really nice. What'd you make it this time? He's like, yeah, I put lamb in it. I was like, you son of a bitch. But at the time I was like, yeah, whatever. So I had some eggs a few times, like the next day and the day after. And then I had a little bit more meat, and honestly, my testosterone just shot through the roof. My strength almost doubled in the preceding 3 weeks. I had a fucking boner for this, like, 3 weeks straight. Like, I was walking around, I wanted to punch every guy out. I wanted to fuck every girl. Like, it was this crazy, like, this resurgence of my hormones. And ever since then, you know, a good 8-9 years ago, I just found through testing it myself that veganism is stupid. I find sometimes if I, you know, go like, I, you know, if I do some juicing or if I, you know, plant-based for a couple of days, I feel like I cleanse my system a little bit. But other than that, like as a long-term method of eating, I discovered myself through experience that it is the dumbest possible way of eating over the long term. So anyway, that's sort of a bit of context for my story. And I always get asked by people, why do you eat so much meat? You know, it's not good for you. You're going to get cancer. You're going to get cholesterol. You're going to get this. You're going to get that. You know, you're going to die young and all this sort of shit. And, you know, people to this day, they're like, oh, you know, you look 26 or 27, and I'm in my mid 30s now. So it's, you know, I don't think what I'm doing is wrong. And it would be incredible for people to hear that, not from me, but from someone with your type of background, and sort of go through this. So maybe where we can start is, you know, if you had a similar story. I think I recall, I've seen an earlier photo of you where you were kind of like fat or something. So maybe you can take us through a little bit about your journey.
So, I mean, you know, like I've always been a big person. I'm, you know, right now I'm 6'5", 250 pounds. So that's 113 kilos or something you know, so, I mean, as I competed as an athlete, there were times when I was 130 kilos, 135 kilos, big guy, Highland Games, powerlifting, you know, I was, you know, in excess of 300 pounds. I was strong. I was eating, you know, and I was eating a lot. I mean, I was eating a lot of protein. I was eating a lot of meat, but I was eating a lot of just everything. You know, it was just anything that was good, I would eat. I mean, I didn't eat a lot of junk food, but you know, there was some in there. I would have desserts with my meals. But, you know, I got to a point where I was, and I was still performing very well as an athlete. And, you know, there's some sports like weightlifting, powerlifting, Highland Games that you can be big and strong and not be cardiovascularly or metabolically in the best health and still excel. And I was doing that, you know, by about the age of 42, that was something where I was like, this isn't working anymore. I mean, it's catching up with me. And so I made this decision that, look, I'm going to lean out. I'm going to change my diet. And I went on a diet that was not vegan. I was never crazy enough or demented enough or stupid enough to go vegan. I don't think I already never appealed to me for whatever reason. I never did it, but I went heavily plant heavy and lean meats and a lot of fiber and a lot of vegetables. And I did that and I legitimately lost weight. I mean, I clearly did. In fact, I went from about 285 down to 230 in about 3 months. So I lost about 50 pounds in 3 months just by, you know, going from 7,000 calories a day to something like 3 or 4, and then working out like, you know, 3 times a day, jumping rope, doing all this stuff. I was like, you know, I'm a competitive guy. I'm not a patient guy. I'm like, get it done now. I'm gonna lose weight. And, you know, and I was like, look how easy this is, right? Anybody can do it. I can do it. And I mean, I got there and I was effing miserable. I mean, I was tired. I was hungry. I was pissed off. The nurses at the hospital, you know, working as a surgeon, the nurses were like, we really much preferred the more jovial Dr. Baker. You know, it's just like, you know, basically, hey, you're stopping an asshole, right? And I mean, because I was hungry all the time and my temper was short and it was a tough time. And so then I was like, look, I need animal fats. I need something in my diet. So I went more paleo-esque, and then I went, you know, then I kind of got to play with low carb and a ketogenic for diet for a while. And then I rolled into, it's been right at 5 years now. 5 years ago, I started really playing with a carnivore diet. And so I've been kind of basically on a carnivore diet since that time. And as a physician, you know, you're kind of like, well, this, when I first saw people doing this, you know, about 6 years ago, when I first was made aware of this, I thought that sounds, I didn't think it sounded dumb, but I thought really weird. I thought it was strange. And, you know, cause it's just not something you normally encounter, you know, no one does this in the United States. Now you go to the North Pole, or, you know, go hang out with the Inuit, or, you know, the Maasai, and you're like, yeah, these people are doing, we don't normally come into contact with those people. But as I looked into it more, as I looked into nutrition, as I started to sort of question what we've been taught and looked into the actual science of nutrition, you come to realize the science is not very good. It's not a pure science. It's really just, you know, it's you know, when engineers look at nutrition studies, when physicists look at nutrition studies, they laugh. It's like, there's no,
they laugh.
This isn't science. This is a lot of feeling, and you know, there's a lot of influence, and there's a lot of corporate interest that dramatically influences our nutrition. But when you start to look at it and you start looking through the lens of other sciences, anthropology, evolutionary biology, you start, and even the historical stuff, you start to see that there's a lot more there besides what we're being told from the USDA, who, you know, interestingly, the USDA sets US dietary policy, but they also have a huge interest in agriculture. I mean, they literally, I mean, the United States runs largely on our agricultural system. I mean, that's been the backbone of the system for years. And so there's a huge conflict of interest there. When you look at, you know, the USDA's job is to promote farming and agriculture, and some of the foods that we make, quite honestly, are just not that good for us. And so we have this, you know, we make a lot of wheat, we make a lot of grain, we got to sell it. So how are we going to sell it? We're going to tell people to eat more of it. And that's really, I mean, that's, you know, there's a lot more to it, but that's kind of some of the basis we start with. And so this demonization of meat that's occurred for the last really about, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 years, I think, you know, it goes back to probably Well, certainly from a religious standpoint, it goes back to, you know, the foundation of the American Dietetics Association back in 1917, where several Seventh-day Adventists who religiously object to eating meat founded the dietetics and the nutrition, basically science. So it's been grounded in that, but, you know, it really took off basically in the 1950s when President Eisenhower had a heart attack. And, you know, it was like, we're going to demonize fats. But, you know, the fact that he was literally smoking four packs of cigarettes a day, you know, back in the early 1950s and 40s, cigarettes were considered still healthy. So we kind of, I can't get the cigarettes. Everybody's doing it. And the doctors say it's good. It's got to be the steak and the beef. And so we've been on this sort of misguided path really ever since. And it's, you know, it's kind of like now, I mean, we've got really literally three generations of people that have been basically brainwashed to believe that meat is unhealthy for you. And, you know, gosh, we should eat lots of fruits and vegetables. And I don't necessarily think that fruits and vegetables are particularly harmful for all people. I've never come across saying that, but this point of this carnivore diet is that meat is not unhealthy. Meat is an incredibly, incredibly powerfully good food for human beings. It's what humans have been, you know, existing on for millennia, if not millions of years, depending on what you believe and how far back you want to call humanity goes. I think it goes back, you know, somewhere around 3 million years. There's other people who disagree with that, but I think that's who we are as a species. And when we eat the interesting thing is, if you look at all species that have ever populated the earth, you know, every single animal that's ever been, that's ever walked, swam, or flown on the earth, something like 85% of them have been carnivorous. Now, there are a lot of herbivores. There are obviously huge, vast swaths of you know, grazing animals across the African plains and the Asian steppe and the North American grasslands. They're numerous, but that's not the main strategy. You know, if you are adapted to eating grass, you're going to do well in the grasslands. But most animal species have opted for carnivory because it's more efficient. It's an easier way to get the nutrition that you need to build the structure of which we are made out of animal cells. I mean, all of us are made out of animal cells. It's easy to run that system when you're consuming those same products. And like I said, it's like trying to build brick houses out of straw. You know, it's hard. I mean, it's the three little pigs, you know, type of thing. You know, the efficiency is much lower.
Yeah. So there's probably two things there. There's the assimilation, but also, I mean, the nutrient density of meat as well versus plants, right? So you've got these animals that are, you know, the herbivores like cow, for example, who goes and eats, nutrient sparse food like grass, and then, you know, eats that shit all day, digests it through God knows how many different elements of the stomach, and you know, transforms that into, you know, itself, you know, as this big animal. And what we do is we come along and we get the nutrient density straight out of the meat, which is kind of like the finished product. And there's like anthropologically speaking, so I've done quite a bit of study anthropologically, and that's one of the reasons why I fundamentally understand why meat is so important. Is one of the things that made us human beings and allowed the prefrontal cortex to evolve was the fact that we were able to shorten our intestinal tract by eating more nutrient dense food. So we could, energy could be used for thinking as opposed to just for digestion. So I think, I don't know if you've got any comments on that, if we can explore that a little bit, because I don't think people realize that.
Sure. You're referring to something called the expensive tissue hypothesis, which was put forward by Aiello and Wheeler in the back in the 1980s. And what it basically indicates is, you know, if we compare ourselves to other primates, you know, our brains are, you know, if you look at the typical chimpanzee brain is around 300 cc's, 300 cubic centimeters. A Homo sapien, a modern Homo sapien, our brain size is somewhere around 1300 cc's. So we've got, you know, roughly four times or a little over four times the brain capacity. That is incredibly energy reliant. And so our brain, which weighs about 2 pounds, you know, makes up about 2% of our actual volume as a human being. It requires something like 20 to 25% of our energy. So it's incredibly energetic. And so there was a trade-off. You know, we look at something when we look at the and I can't remember, there's a Cliver's line. There's a line that shows, you know, energy requirements based on, you know, size of animal and how much energy they're going to use. Humans fall off that line. And the reason for that is our huge, massive brain. And the way we did that was we had to sacrifice something. What we sacrificed was our gut size. The gut is also an energy and expensive organ. And so by sacrificing gut size, the only way we could do that was by make a dietary shift. And you're absolutely right. A chimpanzee spends something like 65% of its waking hours physically masticating and chewing food. A gorilla, it's something like 80% of its waking hours is just dedicated to chewing. They spend all day grazing. Humans don't do that. In fact, based on, you know, skull mechanics and jaw dimensions, humans, ancient humans, you know, the early fossil records indicate that humans spend about 4% of their time chewing compared to 80% for a gorilla. And so what's the difference? Well, it's what you're eating. If you're spending all day eating stems and leafy leaves and, you know, and twigs, the occasional bug, and once in a while a gorilla will take down a little deer, but most of it is going to be this low nutrient dense food that you just, you know, if you're dedicated to eating, that's why often people on a vegan diet eat a massive amount of food. They're constantly hungry. They're eating 6 times a day, 8 times a day. They're constantly chewing all this food. And they're still losing weight, right? They're still struggling, like you experience yourself. When you eat animal dense food, particularly animal fat, you get that nutrition very quickly. You know, mammalian comparative, weaning times. There's another line of evidence here. When we look at weaning times, the average indigenous human is going to breastfeed for about 2.5 years. You know, if we look at people, you know, living in these tribes out in the wilderness, they breastfeed for 2.5 years. And when we compare the brain size, the actual brain growth that occurs after weaning, the only way that's possible is by acquiring an incredibly energy dense diet. And that almost certainly has to be animal-based fat in particular. The reason modern humans can do this and you know, we can get away with that is now we figured out through ultra processing, you know, these rice cereals and these formulas, we can turn food into powder and we can get a lot of energy out of that. So we can still continue to grow our brain, but that's not what we're designed to do. And as a consequence of eating powders, I mean, this is what processed food is. It's basically powderized energy. We get fat. We get filled up with energy with very little nutrition. And that's one of the major problems we have with, you know, processing food. And you can't do that. You know, you see as a vegan, you have to eat such an incredible high quantity of food, you know, all these lentils and you know, leafy greens and, you know, food grains to try to make up for the processing that we do if you're going to do it on a whole food plant-based diet. Whereas if you can eat, you know, you can eat a 16-ounce steak and man, you're good. I mean, you're good for maybe all day, depending on who you are and how big you are. So it's a huge difference. And so, you know, if you look at like the orangutan, which is the most, they breastfeed for the longest, on average about 8 years. They still have this tiny brain because their diet post-weaning is so plant-heavy. You can't grow that big brain. And so the big brain requires either animal source food or in modern times, hyper-processed food, which I think most people would argue is pretty much garbage for us.
Yeah, I think one of the things you mentioned there as well is the fats versus proteins. So, you know, there's a big fallacy amongst plant-based diets where they think that what the plant-based diet might lack at times is protein. And, you know, what they do is they create all these stupid protein powders and, you know, eat extra lentils or nuts and all this sort of stuff. But what they're really missing is the animal fats. I mean, and there's probably actually two parts here is, you know, what I generally eat is I eat more fatty meat. I look for the fattiest cuts I can get. And that's what I primarily focus on, like lean meat and stuff like that. I fucking don't, you know, A, it's not tasty, but B, it's like, may as well eat fucking cardboard. So like for me, I think the fats that you get from animals is part of what helps regulate your hormones. And I mean, I know that more anecdotally and more experientially than factually, scientifically or statistically, but I think maybe we could talk about like, you know, what impact animal fats have on the body, but then also what I've somewhere, I think I read about with protein assimilation, something to do with the quantity of amino acids, of the different amino acids in a protein. The the amount of protein that is able to be assimilated by the body has something to do with the least assimilable amino acid in the chain. So when you're eating vegan proteins, for example, it may have like high quantity of amino acids of a series of them, but there's a series of them which are really low. So you don't get the absorption across the high amounts. So if we could talk to both of those points really quickly, because I think they're really critical for people to understand.
Yeah, I think I'll start with the protein one, because so we know that, first of all, you know, there's been studies they've done where they've actually, even outside of the fact that many plant proteins are low in things like leucine and lysine, which are critical nutrients. And so when you're trying to build muscles or structures in the body, you need all of the essential amino acids. That's why they're essential. You can't just have 8 out of the 9 and say, I'm good to go. Because if you're missing or you're low in that 9th one, it's going to be a rate limiting step. And so, like I said, this is why things like soy, you know, because it is relatively high in protein, tends to be a better plant-based protein. But most of them, the wheats, the corns, most of the plant proteins are very low and limited in many of these things. That's why, you know, eating beans outside of rice, you've got to combine all these foods, and you can do that. But even outside of that, there's been studies they've done where they've actually matched amino acids, where they say you're going to get the exact amount of leucine and lysine and, you know, tryptophan and all these amino acids on a plant-based diet, and we're going to compare that to a meat-based, and these are often done as protein. These are protein match studies with isolates, and so they're taking, say, whey protein versus pea protein or something like that. Even when they match those exactly with gram for gram for amino acid, the plant protein still does worse. And part of that is that sometimes you have these things called anti-nutrients that are found in plants, things like trypsin inhibitor, like soy has something called a trypsin inhibitor, which prevents you to be able to break down the peptides. And so what happens is you just don't absorb as much. So even when they're matched for amino acids, you struggle. But in nature, in natural foods, they don't even come close. And so you have to go out of your way to eat more calories on a plant-based diet to get the same amount of essential amino acids, particularly things like lysine and leucine. And there's other nutrients in there. But outside of just that, we know that there's been studies looking at, you know, the effect of fat on muscle protein synthesis. And there's a lot of other things that we can talk about, but a lot of people are interested in muscle. And I think muscle is important. I think muscle is an important, incredibly important thing you want to hang on to. It serves such an incredible metabolic purpose. It protects us from all kinds of disease, and it improves our longevity. And so you don't have to be giant, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Mr. Olympia, but you need to have a decent amount of muscle, and it's harder to do on a vegan diet. But there's studies out there, Stefan Van Vliet out of Duke University, a nice study looking at, you know, eggs, egg protein, you know, egg whites where you're getting a lot of protein compared to a whole egg, which has the fats in there. And they saw unequivocally, even though the protein amount was matched, the people that got the fats put on more muscle, and it was a significant difference. And so you go from vegan protein, plant protein, which is already down the chain because you don't have the right amount of amino acids. And then if you can match them, you've got to deal with anti-nutrients. And then assuming you can get, you know, even the protein right, you still have the animal fats, which are going to play a role there. So there's several things that are causing a plant-based diet to be harder for things like muscle protein synthesis. And protein plays roles in hormone production, as you pointed out, neurotransmitters. It's not just muscle, it's skin, it's bone, it's you know, it's every organ in your body is dependent upon protein. So this is the protein side of things. And so, you know, it's not that there aren't, you know, because people say, well, look at this bodybuilder who's a vegan. He is putting himself at a tremendous disadvantage. It's like saying, well, look at that great, you know, athlete who doesn't have a leg. That's great. I'm impressed by these guys that are doing things, but they would be a lot better if they had two legs. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, it's just obvious there. But when we go on to fat, again, if we go back, look historically, there's a nice paper that Mickey Bendor co-authored with, and I can't remember Rob, I can't remember the other author's name, but it's out of Tel Aviv. It was published earlier this year or late last year. I think it was late 2020, early 2021. Looking at from multiple disciplines, it was, you know, it was radioisotopic diet, it was fossil records, it was bioenergetics, it was human, you know, human physiology. They looked at several different things, genetic profiling, looking at what humans were doing and why they evolved and what happens. And what we saw was that earlier humans, you know, prior to around 80,000 years ago, survived and subsisted on really fatty animals. These are these mega herbivores, these elephants, these mastodons, these mammoths, which we were able to kill very easily. I mean, you think about it, elephants don't find humans as threats typically. You know, if you go to, and they clearly did not in North America, South America, throughout Asia. You know, they look at humans, you know, look, an average human is 150 pounds. I'm 12,000 pounds. You're a puny little guy. You're no threat to me. But what happened was humans were smart. They were able to, you know, use their brains and they developed tools. And we had these things called spears and eventually some point projectile weapons. And so we were able to take down these elephants at will. Elephant flesh is very fatty in nature. And so this is what fed us that high energy dense food. So that's what we sort of evolved doing, was killing these big fatty animals. I'm not advocating we should be killing elephants to eat them or growing elephants, you know, and having elephant steaks. I mean, it would be interesting to see that, but that's not what we do. I mean, we kind of proxy that with cattle and sheep and other animals, which is one of the reasons we prefer the fattier cuts. But as humans, you know, somewhere around 80,000 years ago, we started to see a significant decline in those animals, partly due to overhunting, particularly their babies. You know, when you kill an elephant, they don't reproduce that frequently. So you don't have to kill that many baby elephants to make that species significantly threatened. Mm-hmm. That's what happened throughout much of the world. Wherever humans went, the megafauna within a few thousand years was decimated. I mean, it's clear. I mean, some people talk about, you know, an asteroid striking, you know, North America 13,000 years ago, but this pattern, you know, existed throughout Australia, throughout Europe, throughout, you know, South America, throughout the Pacific Islands. Wherever humans went, the big animals went away. And so we were left with small animals. And so we had to get creative. We make bow and arrows about 80,000 years ago, so we can start targeting these animals that don't sit there. Because you know, you go, I'm walking around in Washington State, the deer run away when they see me. They're scared of me, whereas the elephants weren't. And so I've got to do things. I've got to eat leaner animals. And now I have to start being creative of where I'm going to get my fat. And then I'm adding carbohydrates in now because the energy is a problem. We've still got this big, you know, energy hog brain, but we don't have the easy access to the fat and the fuel that we once had. And so now we're developing agriculture and we're seeing our teeth fall out and our bones getting weaker and our stature getting smaller. And all those things that, you know, many people don't realize this, but the human brain size peaked around 125,000 years ago at around, for Homo sapiens, something like 1500 cc's. Neanderthals got it up to 1700 cc's. We've had a decrease down to about 1300 cc's for Homo sapiens. Obviously, Neanderthals no longer exist unless you're Texans and Joe Biden calls you a Neanderthal but you know, I mean, this is what happened. Our human brain has shrunk, and you know, and I would argue it's probably getting worse. It's going to get worse, and then we're seeing some evidence of that now with what we're seeing, what we talked about earlier in the show. You know, it's just what it is. You know, we need that to thrive optimally as human beings. Now there is a point where, you know, fat, you know, what you see animals in the wild, you know, protein's not an issue if you're hunting. It's your carnivore protein is not an issue, but getting that fat is hard. Where do lean animals store their fat? They store it in their viscera. That's why you see animals going in, ripping the guts out, eating the perinephric fat, eating the pericardial fat, eating the omenta that surrounds the viscera. Liver is not particularly fatty. You're getting, you know, and people talk about liver and all these organs, but kidney and liver is not high fat. It's really protein rich. I mean, there's some other nutrients there which can be advantageous, but the fat aspect of it, you know, that's why humans and certain other animals, there are only a few animals that can actually crack through long bones, you know, and a lot of it requires tool use. So you can access the marrow, you can crack through the skull. When lions and stuff eat animals, they typically don't get into the skull, which is, again, all this fat, which is contained in the brain. And so fat is definitely a part of it. Now, there are people that go overboard on that. And I will tell you that, you know, you can eat too much fat. I mean, it's not a unlimited amount. I mean, there's an amount you need, and I think it's a pretty significant amount. But there's a point where these people that they get on their ketogenic diets and they're gorging on sticks of butter and they're wondering why they can't lose weight and they're still fat. It's like, hey, there's a point where it's, you know, there's a point where it's too much. And I think that some people find out what that is pretty quickly.
Yeah, interesting. So one of the questions I had here was like a comparison of the ketogenic diet and the carnivore, and what threads you would pull on that make them different, or make, you know, I don't know if superior is the right word, but, you know, could you talk to the two? Like, do you think the overconsumption of fat, you know, is one of the issues with the ketogenic diet, blanketly speaking? Or,
well, I think the ketogenic diet is an artificial construction. I don't think it's, you know, I would say there's probably times when ketosis was advantageous and many people spent time in it. I think that's mm-hmm. consistent with our history. And I think it was probably, you know, you're eating elephant meat, which is not common these days. I mean, it's pretty hard to get that on the menu. I can't go to Outback and ask for an elephant steak. They're likely not to comply. But they, you know, I think that, you know, rather it might have been through activity level reduction of carbohydrates, meal frequency, which is going to drive ketosis for most of humanity if we spent much time in ketosis, which I think we certainly did at sometimes. But this artificial construction that I always have to be in ketosis 24 hours a day, and I'm going to drink MCT oil and suck down exogenous ketones and munch on, you know, sticks of butter and eat these ketogenic products, that is not consistent with, I think, even good health. I mean, I think that's a problem for many people. I think, you know, yeah, I'm going to eat some meat and it's going to come with fat, and that's what I'm going to do. You can go back to the explorer Stefansson, who talked about when he spent his time with the Inuit in the 19, you know, early 19th part of the 20th century, 1920, 1910, where he spent a dozen years and said, meat plus fat. You know, you get to eat meat, you get enough fat. Where'd you get your fat from? It wasn't from, you know, a heavy cream with stevia dessert. It was, you know, it was seal blubber or whatever, or seal oil. I mean, this is where they got it from. And I think that's consistent with, you know, human health. And I think, you know, there's a lot of, you know, we see that with any diet, you know, once you start putting a label on it, it's, you know, it's a year later, the processed foods company are coming out with their healthy seal of approval. We see that with the plant. This is what I see right now. And I'll keep going to not to keep going back to the plant-based stuff, but we have this trend, this environmental greenwashing of plant-based diets that, you know, and health washing, you know, if you put powered by plants, or you put some little leaf on the front of them, on the label, what that says to me is you made a product, you're using cheap products, and you're going to make a lot of profit off that. And the stupid mm-hmm. consumer, and, you know, the zombies are running around here. Give me more. It's got a leaf on the cover, so I'm going to eat it. And it's got to be good for me. You're just basically, you're kind of an idiot, you know, because you're falling for the marketing. And that's what we're seeing. You know, I mean, if you need to put a green leaf on a package of processed food to tell me it's healthy for me, go eat a damn apple out of the produce aisle. I mean, I tell you to do that before I tell you to eat that. You know, or even better, eat a steak, you know, or you know, something else that's actual food and not this garbage. But that just tells me whenever I see powered by plants, or somebody tell me something that's made with plant-based protein, all I'm thinking is you're cutting corners, you're saving money, and you're ripping me off.
Yeah, literally. I think one of the things you mentioned there about the ketogenic diet, and this is, you know, because I tried veganism, I tried ketogenic, I tried all sorts of shit. And over time, what I've kind of discovered just through personal experimentation again is I try and eat food just in as close to its natural state as possible. Like I never eat processed food, or unless you could argue that ground beef is processed, right? But like other than that, like I my diet primarily consists of eggs, meat, you know, I love my fatty cuts. So generally like brisket or beef cheek or ribs, they're generally my favorite. I'm not actually a big steak eater. I don't like the texture of steak, but I absolutely love like the slow cooking some brisket and then just, you know, seeing that fall apart. I'll eat avocados. I'll eat, you know, not a huge amount of cheese, but, you know, some cheese. And then depending if I am doing like the brisket, I'll throw some sweet potato and things like that in there. But that's generally, you know, what my diet revolves around. Now, I guess, you know, what would be your assessment on that, like for most people? Like, you know, do you think that's, you know, a good heuristic for, or a good style for most people to eat? Or would you say, like, you know, because I know some people are super strict carnivore. They're like, nope, it's fucking meat, salt, and water, and that's all you need. You know, versus, you know, where I add the eggs, etc.
You know, so I basically coined the term carnivore diet. I mean, I didn't invent eating meat. There's a lot of people that have eaten meat-based diets, but I basically slapped the label on the carnivore diet. That's me that started mm-hmm. that, you know, and for better or worse. I think what you're describing is a pretty damn good diet. I think many people, I think humans are opportunistic omnivores. I think we're facultative carnivores, and there's some semantic hoops you jump through there. What that means is I think we do very well on meat. I think meat is a very good part of our diet. I think people that do strict carnivore diets, you know, and I do them and I've done them and I continue to do them. I've done them for years. I think it's a great way to do it. Do I think that everybody needs to be on that? No. Do I think it's the optimal diet for all people? No. I think that, you know, if you can tolerate certain fruits, and you're describing basically fruit and some dairy, basically avocados, most people don't always, is that technically considered a fruit biologically? I think humans would have done that. I mean, clearly, if I was walking through the woods 50,000 years ago and I came across a patch of berries that didn't kill me, and I realized that these things are things I could eat and weren't going to kill me, I would clearly have eaten them, and probably, you know, would have done that in January in Canada or Northern Europe. I probably wouldn't have opportunity to do that. And so I think that's reasonable. But again, at the end of the day, I've got people that, you know, will try to include fruit in their diet, and they just get, it doesn't work for them for whatever reason. You know, there's compounds, there's plant compounds, there's toxicities, there's chemicals in everything we eat, whether it's meat or eggs or plants. And for some reason, some people don't tolerate them. And I think part of that reason really is a modern diet has effed everybody up. I mean, your guts are destroyed. You're eating this, you know, high fructose corn syrup, the soybean oil. The average American eats more calories from soybean oil than they do from beef, which I think is a shocking statistic. I mean, it's amazing, but that's the reality of what the modern diet has done. And we talked about the powderized food and the hyper-processed and ultra-processed concentrated fats and oils and carbohydrates and grains and even protein powders. I think that's jacked us up. And so we cannot tolerate things that we could have tolerated maybe 100 years ago. And so I think that's part of the problem. So it's not that I'm saying that everybody should, no one should eat an apple and no one should eat a banana and no one should eat whatever, a tomato. But there are people where it's a problem. It's a serious problem. And I can't help but see it every single day. I see people, and I think the easiest thing is to say, cut out all that shit, just go to meat for a while and see how you do. And for some people, that's, they're happy with that. And I don't think I don't think eating meat as all of your diet or the mass majority of your diet for decades is a problem, because there are societies that have done that and have demonstrated robust health and vigor. You can't tell me, you know, you look at the Maasai warriors who drink eating meat and milk primarily and have done so for thousands of years, presumably, are fat. They're not. They're skinny, they're lean, they're muscular, active people that thrive. And yeah, they've been exposed to the modern diet, so have gotten sick now because of that. But this is a viable way to live. It's also a viable way to live on meat plus, you know, I think meat plus whatever is, whatever you want to put in there can be potentially very healthy for people. And at the end of the day, the proof's in the pudding. If you are healthy and you feel good and you look and you feel like you look young and you're happy where you are and you smile a lot and you wake up with a heart on and you've got a zest for life and nothing hurts and everything feels good and your guts don't hurt and your brain functions and your joints work and you can run and sprint and play and, you know, I'm 55. I'm almost 55 years old, and I'm doing that stuff as an old guy. You know, I don't consider myself old. I feel like I'm still got a lot to live in the world. I think that's great. I think that's a great way to be. And I think the problem we get into this is we start, medicine starts interfering and it tells you that, oh my gosh, well, data that shows that people eat meat and junk food and sugar, that's always in there, don't live as long. We think they don't live as long, or their cholesterol is high, and oh my gosh, it's associated with heart disease. That has nothing to do with health. That has nothing to do with you cannot predict what I'm going to die of. I'm probably going to die of heart disease. I don't really care. I'm going to die of something at some point. I mean, I'd rather, quite honestly, I'd rather die of heart disease than being brain dead from dementia or having cancer or, you know, whatever, you know, or being weak and sarcopenic and frail and breaking down and breaking my hip at 65 or 70 years of age and then having an awful quality of life. I don't want that. You know, I'd rather go out, you know, in a blaze of glory, so to speak. You know, it's one of those things where we don't even know how to evaluate or even define health anymore. You know, people, you know, they're like, well, you went to the doctor and labs look great. Yeah, but I feel like shit. I can't get it up and I'm depressed. Well, your labs look good, so you're fine. That's how we tend to define health, and it's not. Or if that is the case, you're complaining about the fact, here's a drug, here's a pill. You must have a drug deficiency. You've got a Lipitor, a Viagra, and a Effexor deficiency. Let me remedy that. That's not what's going on. Insane. No one's got a drug deficiency, right? But that's what we've devolved into. And I don't know how this ties into Bitcoin, but I think you can see the parallels. Fiat food, fiat health, fiat money. I mean, you know, we've devolved as a species, unfortunately.
Live
in the bush or live in the woods and just, you know, make your own food and just leave me alone. You know, maybe like I said, I'm not there yet. Give me another 10 years. Maybe I'll have a mountain hideaway with a bunch of guns and, you know, some cows and a property and say, F all you guys. We'll see.
We're all nearing that patience threshold, my friends. Look, I think what you mentioned there about, there was a couple of threads I want to pull on. I'm going to go back to an earlier thread about when people come to you and you just get them to kind of like get rid of everything and just start with meat and then build up. So I remember Jordan Peterson on the Joe Rogan podcast, you know, a couple of years ago was talking about how, you know, he just cut out everything other than, you know, meat, salt, and water. And sometimes I wonder is like, I know that mixing a lot of foods causes a lot of havoc in people's stomachs because of the different enzymes that are required to digest things. And, you know, like just mixing food in general is, as far as I understand, not a very good idea. So do you think there's, you know, some of the benefit that's associated with people going like full on just meat comes from actually eliminating all the unnecessary or all of the extra stuff that might cause it? Because I'll use this example. If I go and slow cook some brisket and I eat just the brisket, I feel really, really good. But oftentimes I'll slow cook the brisket with some pumpkin, with some sweet potato and everything, because I love that shit and it tastes all nice. And then I'll eat them together and I'll feel a little bit bloated afterwards. And I don't know if that's the pumpkin or the sweet potato or if it's the mixture of the meat and the carbs together. Like, do you have any insight on that?
Well, I mean, there's a whole, I don't know if you want to call it science, but there's a definitely a thought about food combining. There's books written on this, and I kind of look at that and I'm like, well, I'm not really that interested. But we do know, for instance, that when it comes to absorption characteristics, we do know that certain foods will significantly impede the absorption of nutrients. And so we know that, say, if you're eating black beans with, a protein source, the protein absorption is dramatically, or the zinc, I think I saw a study looking at, like, it was scallops and black beans and corn tortillas, and we saw that I think it was the phytic acid or the lectins dramatically decreased the zinc absorption. So we do see that foods compete with absorption characteristics. So when you're eating, and it's typically a plant food of some sort, it interferes with the ability. We've seen that, like, for instance, there's this concern about methionine and glycine when it comes to meat. You know, if you eat too much methionine, muscle meat, you got to balance it with collagen, and that's based on rat studies. But what we see is glycine absorption is significantly decreased by eating carbohydrates, glucose or galactose. So if you're eating any glucose in your diet, it's going to dramatically impede the glycine absorption. So we do see that the foods that are combined with other foods generally, in most cases, negatively impact the overall absorption characteristics. Now, that is something that when we look at the RDAs, for instance, you know, the assumptions are made that we're eating a mixed diet. And that's why things like vitamin C, things like magnesium, perhaps manganese and these other things are assuming that you're eating a hamburger with French fries and a bun. And that's how they determine these numbers. And so when they say, well, you need to get X amount of grams of this or that, it's based on the fact that you're eating a mixed diet. Now, when you don't eat a mixed diet, things dramatically change. You know, how much vitamin C you might require, how much manganese you might require, how much zinc you might require, how much vitamin D you require. the problem is we don't have a lot of data on people that are eating these weird, crazy carnivore diets, or even there's probably more data on vegan diets. But what I'm seeing is, you know, when I look at it on paper, you know, why don't I have scurvy? Why are my teeth aren't falling out? Why am I not developing hemarthrosis, my bloody joints, which these are hallmarks of scurvy, if I'm not eating any, you know, enough vitamin C? Well, the answer is, one, I'm eating a lot of carnitine, which vitamin C is useful for, you know, the utilization of carnitine. I'm producing a lot of uric acid, perhaps. Uric acid is an antioxidant. You know, most people can associate uric acid with things like gout, and vitamin C is also an antioxidant. But when uric acid is elevated, vitamin C goes down. We know that red cells recycle vitamin C. So there's all these things that, yeah, when you're combining foods, you're changing the absorption characteristics. So I can speak to that. Now, do we have, you know, are you, like you're saying, I'm experiencing bloating and gas. I think that's honestly probably the fiber in the food. Mm-hmm. You know, if you just eat a steak, I mean, I've sat there and eaten 3 or 4 pounds of ribeye steak in one sitting, and literally I don't even know I'm digesting anything an hour later. I'm like, did I even eat anything? I can't feel it. I don't feel bloated and swollen like you do once you eat a whole bunch of potato chips or a whole bunch of whatever sugar, or, you know, particularly vegetables. And I don't do this anymore. I mean, I've done it in years, but if I were to eat a big salad, I mean, an hour later, I'd be like, oh man, my stomach really hurts. I mean, it literally hurts because you're having all this gas being liberated. And one of the things we see, there's a gastroenterologist, Pran Yoganathan, out of Sydney, Australian, that has really looked into, because he's gotten enamored with the carnivore diet, or at least the perspective of carnivore, and he's kind of gotten less excited about fiber, and he sees that fiber leads to digestive, the production of methane and bloating and all these gases. And what happens is it goes retrograde, it goes backwards. And so a lot of people start developing belching and burping and reflux as their guts are bloating down below. And so gas has to go one way or the other. And so the etiology of reflux, which we associate with gastric acid production, and we always, you know, we tend to give people drugs to suppress their acids production. They then can't tolerate meat. They can't digest fat and protein because their acid suppression has been so significant. But what's really happening is the bloating from the fiber and the gas, and sometimes fat, leads to this backfilling, this pressure coming up, and then you get this reflux, and then everybody puts you on these protein pump inhibitors. They tell you not to drink coffee, not to eat chocolate, don't eat red meat. And it's just backwards. We don't know how to treat the etiology of how it is. I mean, the answer is, yeah, we're going to give you these proton pump inhibitors, suppress your acid production, and you no longer can tolerate food, you know, and you get weaker, and you stop absorbing protein, and your bones get softer, and on and on and on. Your brain gets affected by this stuff. So it's there's definitely something to do with different foods.
It's wild. I want to pull on that thread, but just want to ask one more thing. So with respect to mixing foods, so a lot of people will use the counter of, you know, carnivore is extreme, you know, or you're missing nutrients, or you need some sort of, you know, the proverbial fucking balanced diet, right? Like, where you need a little bit of everything. So, you know, what's some of the fallacies or stupidities around this idea of, you know, you need to eat a little bit of everything, you know, and where does that potentially fall over? And can you get everything that the body needs, you know, primarily from meat? Like, are you missing anything?
Yeah, I think you could. I think people run very well on meat-based diets. They've done that. They've demonstrated they've done that for thousands of years. But I mean, when we talk about the balanced diet, I need to eat the rainbow. I need to eat a wide variety of foods. What I would ask you, and when you look at some of these food plans that sort of dictate that you do that, and you look at the foods that are on the menu, you're like, that grows in Mexico, that only grows in Brazil, that only grows in Africa. And you're like, these foods are not even present on the same continent, or at least historically. And so you're like, how would someone who lived even 100 years ago or 200 years ago, how would they have ever eaten this way? Because not only does this food not even grow in the same region, it doesn't even grow on the same continent. And they have people telling Eskimos, you know, Inuit, that they're supposed to be eating fruits and vegetables. And they're like, where the hell would these people have ever been able to get bananas and mangoes and pineapples and tomatoes and spinach and kale? It doesn't exist. And if you tell me that you need to eat these five magic super berries, I'm like, where does it grow? Can you show me a plant that grows everywhere throughout the world in all seasons and all geographic locations to tell me that humans have to eat that as a requirement? You know, it just doesn't line up. It doesn't make sense. Most people, you know, if you talk to your Indigenous Australians, their diet probably would have consisted of what they could find locally, a few foods. Most people, you know, in Europe and North America, I mean, they would eat 10, 20 foods. That would be it. That's the maximum they had access to in any significant qualities and quantities. And so we're saying, eat this balanced diet of, you know, rich amounts of antioxidants and all these colorful fruits. They're impossible. They are impossible without modern refrigeration, modern grocery stores, modern, you know, transportation systems. So it's like, it's the most ludicrous presumption that you need that to be healthy. It just doesn't match up with anything out of, you know, assuming we believe that humans have existed for at least a few thousand years. Even if you're a diehard creationist, human beings have been here at least for a few thousand years. You can go back to the Egyptians and the Jewish populations and the Romans. And we know clearly humans have been around for a few thousand years. They could not have eaten a balanced diet, the one you're describing. It just doesn't exist, you know? And so I kind of think it's laughable to suggest that you're supposed to be eating all these crazy foods that don't grow.
So in some ways, you know, people are doing more damage to themselves by broadening the amount of food that they're eating, right? Is like their digestive system and their actual body is confused as fuck about what am I doing with all of this stuff. And, you know, does that sort of play into the whole, you know, mixing of foods as well starts to like have an impact?
I think that the answer is usually taking something away. You know, it's like if you go to the doctor, and you're in there, you're whacking your head over with a mallet continuously. And the doctor says, here, take this headache pill, take this aspirin, yep, because it's going to help with the pain. And you're like, the average person was like, why don't you take the fucking hammer out of his hand and tell him to stop hitting himself in the head? Right? I mean, this is what we're doing. We're like, I've got gut problems. I must need this berry from that only grows in the Andes Mountains in South America. How does that make sense? You know, I mean, you're obviously, you know, like I said, you're exposing yourself to something that's not agreeing with you. It's not, the answer isn't taking some frigging magic pill that this tribe from South America has discovered to see, because you see this all the time. All this, they live a long time and they're healthy. Well, they're eating fucking garbage.
Yeah,
that's what they're doing. They're not, it's not some magic pill or berry that they're taking. It's not some super antioxidant pill derived from some magic berry that grows only in July in the Andes. It's not the solution to your problem. The solution to your problem is stop eating fucking garbage all day long. Eat what you're designed to eat as a human being. Eat what, you know, simplify, take away stuff. Don't add bullshit in there. I mean, that's what we see so much.
Thank you.
Laughable.
I really appreciate that, because I think that's one of the things, as I think a marker of wisdom is, you know, it's analogous to people, how can I say, the world is full of so much noise at the moment that everyone thinks that they're missing stuff, when in reality, they're layered with so much shit that, you know, when it comes to information, when it comes to, you know, diet, when it comes to like, you know, your finances, like less is more. Like the more simple it is, the better it is. And you know, we're being sold all of these con jobs of like, oh, what you're missing is another fucking magic pill or another, you know, TV show or another fucking, you know, therapist or something like that. And it's crazy.
Well, I mean, I think you'll appreciate that, you know, my friends, you know, Safety, you know, who's obviously very popular in the Bitcoin space. You know, it's like, we want the latest shiny thing. It's the latest super berry. And we're always chasing this stuff when we don't get our house in order. It's like the latest, whatever the latest coin is, you know, the latest altcoin. It's the, you know, it's the safe moons and the, you know, it's on and on and on. Everybody's going to keep reaching for the next thing. I need this new cryptocurrency. I need this new superberry. I need this new magic pill. You come back, you bring it in, you simplify it, and things work really well. And you feel a lot better. And you know, I mean, you know, you can see the analogies that we draw here. But I mean, from a nutrition side, which I feel much more comfortable talking about, obviously, simplify the stuff, eliminate all these confounders. You don't need the latest whatever, you know, the latest magic food, the latest magic, you know, and these companies are really good at selling you. I mean, you see that people are very good at marketing. You know, there's a sucker born every minute, and people know how to capitalize, and they know how to use these high tech, very sophisticated marketing tools. And you've got, you know, Silicon Valley preys upon this. I mean, they don't care. I mean, they just want to make money. They don't care if it works. Can I sell it? Can you make me $1 billion? Yes, I'll give you the marketing team. Yes, here's your $25 million in seed fund, you know, your Series A round. I mean, that's what you get. I mean, and it works very well. And people are, you know, like I said, there's a sucker born every minute. That work. I mean, that's part of the market we see.
Yeah. Couple more things, because I know you're short on time. So I wanted to mention one thing you reminded me of earlier, where you talked about you know, the modern definition of health is, you know, the modern definition of disease is the absence of some sort of drug that you haven't started taking yet, right? Like, you know, the only reason you have depression is because you're not taking Prozac. You know, if you have enough Prozac in your body, then you won't be depressed. You'll be happy about life. But I remember I studied some naturopathy in the early days, and it's an interesting study. I didn't agree with a lot of things in there, but, you know, one of the things that led me down that path, and they criticized the modern medical practice a lot, in the sense of, you know, modern medicine tries to frame health as the absence of visible disease. And it's like, well, that's a really low bar for health. Like, if health is the absence of it, you know, that means most of the world is healthy, when in reality, no one is. Like, everyone feels like shit. Everyone's walking around, they're fucking fat, they're tired, you know, they've got dark circles under their eyes, their hair's falling out, you know, they're like, it's a really, I don't know, pathetic version of health. So anyway, I wanted to mention that, because it reminded me when I was studying naturopathy, I was like, what the fuck is this? How do we sit by and like swallow these definitions? It's strange. But
I mean, the reality is most people don't care. I mean, most people don't, I mean, they don't think or worry about health until they've had their first heart attack, they need a knee replacement, they get cancer, maybe one of their loved ones has a healthcare or dies. I mean, most people, again, this is a problem. I mean, it's a brilliant strategy. I mean, you dumbed down and made the population comfortable. You've got people that, you know, you're gonna give them universal basic income, a Netflix account, some virtual reality pornography, and cheap junk food. And I mean, you've got a class of people that are continually vote for you and buy your products. I mean, this is what you have.
This
is a modern form of slavery. Yeah, they're pets. They're pets. They're zombies. Whatever you want to call them, they are. I mean, they're enslaved by this stuff. They're enamored with the technology, the cheap fiat food, fiat technology, whatever you want to call it. And they're good to go. I mean, it's like, we want to bring the entire, you know, we've got a few people that are going to sit there, and they're got this, and everybody else has got their little, you know, their little level of happiness, which is very low. We're lowering the bar across the board. And I think that's a grave disservice to humanity. We need to be bringing everyone up. And I think that's some of the things that I think Bitcoin attempts to do. You know, I think we talk about, you know, at least from a financial and monetary standpoint, you know, bring people up rather than just dumb everybody down, which I think is what we're seeing now.
Absolutely, absolutely. A couple rapid fire questions. What are your, what's your opinion on like some of the best cuts of meat? Like, what do you personally like? And, you know, what do you think, you know, are good cuts of meat for people to eat?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I mean, I think the easy answers are, you know, the prime, well marbled fatty cuts of meat. You know, I think those things are, they're no-brainers, because they don't take much skill to deal with. I mean, it's, you know, if you can have a frying pan, you can make a ribeye steak good. And if you can't do that, you know, you need to check how many brain cells you have, because those say, you know, I mean, some of them take more work. I mean, there's some great things that take more work, like brisket, for instance. To make a brisket, you're going to need, you know, 12, 14, 16 hours typically, and some skill with that. I think that fillets are, you know, they're phenomenal. I mean, it depends on, you know, what your goals are and how much fat you find you want to eat or need to eat. I've gotten to where I'm having a lot of fun sous videing stuff. So you can make some of the more challenging cuts of meat very palatable and very flavorful and very, very tasty if you're willing to invest the time and learn how to prepare them and you know, slow roasting and smoking and sous videing and things like that. So you can make anything taste good. And I think, I mean, obviously I have found recently, like lamb, I've fallen back in love with lamb. I've been a big fan of beef, as an American, beef is, and as a Texan, beef is a big thing. You know, the brisket I think you've had in Austin, Texas, maybe, and it's just phenomenal. It's out of this world.
I haven't yet, but I want to.
Well, when you get there, when you go through Texas, I know Austin's become kind of a Bitcoin hub, and just like Miami has. Austin has some tremendous stuff. I mean, Miami's got this great, you know, Cuban and South American, and so you might get some of the picanhas out there. They're in the Brazilian stuff. But I think that, you know, with the lamb, when I lived in New Zealand, I played professional rugby in New Zealand for a period of time, way 30 years ago. I mean, I got overdosed on lamb. I mean, it was because lamb is, you know, all over New Zealand. Same thing, Australia is quite a bit of lamb, but New Zealand is particularly, you know, lamb is everywhere. There's 3 million sheep and another 60 million sheep and 3 million people. And, you know,
yeah. All jokes
about the sheep, but I mean, I had it every, I mean, I literally, every time I went, it was roast kumara and lamb. I mean, that was a dish I got that all the time. And I kind of got like, I was tired of lamb. But I've recently kind of rediscovered my little, it was kind of funny. My son was asking for some, he went and had some Greek heroes and he had some lamb. He said, I really like lamb, so I'll buy some for you. I got some lamb chops and we started eating those. It was like, wow, this is really, it's really good stuff. So anyway.
Do you do bone broths or bone marrow or organs or any of that sort of stuff?
I do a little bit. I do some bone marrow. When I get marrow bones, I think I find it delicious. It's a great topping to put on a steak. Mm-hmm. I've done bone broth. I've done organs a little bit. I'm not one of these people that believes you must have them to be successful in the diet, because I've just seen too many people thrive without it. And I've largely not eating them. And I would argue I'm doing pretty damn well. I mean, I've tried them all. I mean, I'm not really enamored with the taste of liver or kidney or brain. I mean, I've had them all, sweetbreads. I've had testicle. I've had whale blubber. I've had shark. I've had all kinds of crazy stuff. But I mean, what I honestly like, and I think a diet where you have to sit there and hold your nose and pretend you like something, it's not something you're going to sustain. Don't F with that. I mean, if you don't like it, don't eat it. Yeah. I mean, conversely, if you've never had it, try it, see, and see if it, because I mean, there literally are people that say, I feel a lot better when I consume, you know, organ X, Y, Z, when I have a little bit of liver. And I don't doubt them. And I don't think that's not true. But there are people out there that are saying, you must eat X amount of organs to be successful on a meat-based diet. That's frankly, is quite honestly, it's mostly nonsense. I mean, and many of those people, unfortunately, you know, have a supplement business that sells organ meat supplements on the side. I find that a little bit of a conflict of interest, quite honestly. You know, so I think, you know, try it. If you like it, fine. I mean, this story about the indigenous people value and prize these organs because they're fucking starving. They live in the middle of fucking nowhere and they're scrapping every calorie. That's why they eat everything. You know, why do wolves and lions eat organs first, or what some of them do? Because that's where all the fat is. I think it's really this conflation of needing fat for these other things. You know, I think, you know, like I said, I don't begrudge people or tell people not to do that stuff. You know, if you want to eat eyeballs and cow dicks and brains and, you know, whatever, and knock yourself out. If you enjoy it, fine. If you can make it palatable, good. I think, you know, there's a difference between subsistence eating and, you know, eating from a surplus. And I think humans mostly ate from a surplus. We were awesome hunters. I mean, that's all we did. We were the most successful hunting population on the planet. We killed the fuck out of these animals. We ate the crap out of them. And so we probably ate the good stuff. I mean, that's what I would do. I mean, if there's a bunch of ribeyes and a bunch of, you know, mammoth dicks, I'm going to go with the ribeyes until they run out. And then if I'm hungry, I'm going to go kill another mammoth. I'm going to leave the dicks for the guy that, you know, we're pissed off at, perhaps. I don't know.
Crazy. Do you do any seafood or?
I do. Yeah. I mean, I'm in the Pacific Northwest, so I'll eat clams and mussels and crabs and, you know, and I'll have some, you know, I had some salmon the other night. Yeah. I mean, I don't find it like, wow, I really need seafood. I don't really crave it, but if it's around and it's available, and I'll eat it from time to time, but I'm not sitting here like I must eat, you know, 500 grams of salmon every week to get my omega-3s. I'm not doing that stuff. I mean, I tend to just, you know, eat food I like. And, you know, I like seafood from time to time, but I don't find that I must eat it to be successful.
Okay. Supplementation, do you do anything? Not really.
So I do, I'll do some electrolytes. I mean, if you want to consider that supplements, I mean, that's primarily what I find. Do I find it absolutely necessary? Probably not, but I do like to put salt on my food, and there is an issue with sodium, particularly with low carb diets, and we tend to lose sodium. I mean, early on, we certainly do. And so it's probably wise to consider adding that on in the beginning, but after you reach a steady state, you kind of get into a situation where things balance out. Meat has sodium in it, has potassium, just like our muscles do, just like our body does, just like our blood has, you know, and so that kind of evens out. But I mean, I find if I'm going to be doing like a lot of sweating, if I'm working out really hard, sometimes acutely, I'll add, you know, some sort of electrolyte drink or sodium in before I work out. So that's about it for supplements for me.
I was going to say, there's a lot of these new protein powders that are like, you know, collagen and, you know, beef protein and like, you know, these new ways. Like, do you not touch any of that shit?
So, I mean, I've had people send me that stuff, you know, just because they send me shit, because people send me stuff because I'm Japanese. I mean, people send me meat, so I eat it. So sometimes I'll try that. I haven't really said, wow, this is the greatest thing in the world. I got to do it. I've had some collagen. I've had whey protein. I mean, I've had whey protein for years. I think the problem we see with, you know, these things that people tend to use them as substitutes rather than supplements. And so they're like, well, I don't need a steak. I'm going to eat a whey protein. You miss out so much in that stuff. And so it's a problem. I find it, particularly with regard to protein, I don't struggle to get protein. I mean, I just don't find protein to be an issue on a carnivore diet. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, even collagen. I mean, the average American that's eating a standard American junk diet, which is 70% plant-based and only about 5% of the calories are actually coming from meat, may benefit from like a collagen supplement or even a protein supplement. But if you're eating steak, I mean, about 3% of a steak is collagen just by with an intramuscular stuff. And if you're eating gristle or any of the really chewy steaks, you're getting even more. But I mean, that's even just eating a bunch of steak, like if you're eating like, you know, a pound or two of steak a day or three or four, like I do, I'm eating more collagen than 99.999% of Americans just because I'm doing that, because there's collagen within muscle. So the need to supplement collagen for a carnivore diet person is probably pretty low. The average American, a plant-based person, yeah, probably it's probably makes sense.
Okay. Do you have 5 or 10 minutes left for another couple of quick questions, or are you short on time?
I do have to head out in just a few, but yeah, like we can do a few more questions. Okay.
I was going to ask about like qualities of meat as well, because I think if there was one thing when I was, you know, vegan and fucking around, like that I kind of learned was, you know, the difference between, you know, buying a grass-fed, like, you know, organic cut of meat versus like the shit that you get at the supermarkets that, you know, comes from concentrated animal farming operations and all that kind of crap. Like there is at least for me, a significant difference when I eat one meat versus another. Like, do you have any comments on like quality of the meat?
Yeah, first of all, I mean, it's not a black and white issue. I mean, first of all, it's not like I eat grass fed, I'm better. I you know, grain fed, I'm awful. There's so much information that's difficult to see because, you know, just with the food labeling laws, first of all, if you go to the store and say, I'm going to eat, it says grass fed, it doesn't really even mean what you think it means. It means that, you know, the animal had access to grass. It means, did they eat it? Who knows? I mean, you know, the labeling is kind of deceptive. So first of all, you don't really know. Secondly, when we talk about, you know, the difference in what's in meat, what's found in meat, there's more than what happens on how it's finished, you know, because all cows start out on grass. Some of them end up with grain for the last, you know, 3 months typically. But it depends on the breed of the cattle. It depends on the sex of the cattle. It depends on the age of the cattle. It depends on the time of the year they were slaughtered, is what's in that meat at the time. It depends on the region of the country it was raised in. So all these things are going to have impacts on that. When we look at, you know, you talk about a CAFO, confined animal feeding operation, how it's defined. There are crappy CAFOs and there are actually good CAFOs. You know, there are farmers that are doing things and treating their animals very well, and they have very good practices and hygiene practices and animal outcomes. They're not standing in shit all the time, depending on where they're at. So there's so much nuance. So there's a guy on TikTok called the Iowa Dairy Farmer, who you may have seen, and he technically qualifies as a CAFO, but his cows are, I mean, they're well ventilated. The health is immaculate. They're comfortable. They're happy. But they would fall under a CAFO. But some people say, well, you're doing a good job. So it's not as black and white as you see. We have data, like, again, there's a study that Harvard University has done that I helped to organize that will be published later this year, probably in the Journal of Nutrition. I just talked to the senior researcher, David Ludwig, and they looked at grain fed finished versus grass finished. And the data from that is not going to show much different when it comes to health outcomes. And so I think when we talk about human health outcomes, the differences are probably not as significant as many people make it out to be. Probably, it's probably not significant, quite honestly. But there are differences in environmental outcomes. And so when we talk about if I'm concerned about the planet, I think meat eater should be. I mean, we shouldn't just say, oh, you know, leave it to the vegans to save the planet. But, you know, and I think there's a lot of I mean, we could talk hours on this topic, but I think when it comes to how meat is raised, we should understand how it's raised. We should do what we think personally is something we agree with. And there are farmers that, you know, there are people out there that don't like the fact that cows are given grain or pigs or chickens are given grain. There are people that don't like the fact that they're housed inside. There are options. You can buy cows that are raised in different ways and that are potentially more environmentally sustainable, however you want to define that. So I think it is an issue. It's an important issue to understand. I think the health side of it is less of an issue, quite honestly, but I think the environmental side is important. I mean, most people you can say, well, you know, cows eating grain produce more methane. It's actually backwards. Actually, cows eating grass produce more methane. And so when you're talking about just environmental emissions, but then when you go to the sequestering side, the carbon sequester side, we're seeing that cows that are in pasture, particularly if they're managed well, because there can be a grass-finished cow that can be environmentally destructive. I mean, they're just, you know, there's a guy named Greg Judy, who's a great guy, and he talks about the Columbus method, where you just take your cow, you put them in a pasture in May, and you bring them back in October. And you don't do any management. You just let them eat grass. Those guys are actually environmentally destructive. You know, because I'll see cows out in the field just munching on the grass, and most people drive by and goes, "Oh, look at the happy cows." You know, that's your perception of what the cow thinks is happy. You know, I mean, this is what you think makes a cow happy may not be what a cow thinks makes them happy. And the other thing is that, you know, when we see these cows that are not being moved every 24 hours to 48 hours, you're probably actually causing more environmental damage, even though it's grass finished versus a cow that's been moved every hour. So there's a lot of nuance in this topic, and it's you know, we could literally spend, you know, hours talking about it. And I often do, but I know it's not the, you know, the focus of this podcast, but suffice it to say, yes, there are differences in the way we raise cows. The health differences are not, again, it's just not as black and white as you think it is.
Yeah, interesting. Because the heuristic that I generally go by is, and we'll finish on this note, is I think, you know, let's say poorly run CAFOs and monocrop, the monocrop culture, you know, of like wheat and soy and all this sort of shit has actually destroyed and eroded the topsoil around the world. Whereas like allowing cows to just literally eat grass and shit and, enrich the soil is, I think, one of the things that's lacking in the world today. And like all this crap about greenhouse gases and everything, I think is a big fucking sham. Like, In fact, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that greenhouse gases are extraordinarily important, because what they're doing is they're helping green the planet. But anyway, that is another complete tangent. I just sort of, similar to, I guess, the heuristic around what to eat, you know, eating food that's, you know, least processed and, you know, as close as possible to, you know, what you would have eaten had you not had supermarkets and everything else around. You know, that's a good general heuristic around, you know, what to eat. I think similarly with, you know, raising animals, you know, I think a good heuristic is let them eat some fucking grass, let them shit all over the place, and, you know, let that enrich the soil. But anyway, that's sort of, I guess, the simple rules of thumb, which I think we try and make way too complex in the world, as we do with everything else. You know, it's sort of like complexity is the enemy of, you know, is the enemy of progress in many ways, or the enemy of fucking happiness. But anyway, Sean, thank you for taking the time. I, you know, I wish we had some more time, because I'd love to dig into that last topic a little bit more. But hey, you know, we'll do it in the future. You know, me and Safe. Yeah, me and Safe have talked a lot. We will. In fact, what I'll probably do is I'll see if I can get Saifuddin rounded up, so that way we can do sort of like the three of us, because me and Saifuddin have spoken about that ages multiple times. We're like, we'll fix the deserts by getting cows to shit all over the place.
Yeah. It's interesting. I've talked to Marty Band, and I've talked to, I know there's a guy, I don't even know his real name, Untapped Growth, who's in the Bitcoin space.
And then Joel. Poof,
who I think I'm supposed to interview. you got our all little pseudonyms on Twitter, although I'm on, since I'm now at least temporarily, maybe permanently banned from Twitter, I'll have to figure this out. But yeah, I'd love to talk. I'd love to do it again. I love it. You know, obviously I certainly enjoy talking with Saif, and you know, anyway, I appreciate the opportunity. This has been a lot of fun. Unfortunately, I have to go back to real world and do some stuff here very shortly. So it was good talking.
Sweet. All right, Sean. Thank you, buddy. Take care, man.
Alex.